This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Eric Richens called his friend Joshua Kays on Valentine's Day 2022. That detail alone should stop you. Why? And because Valentine's Day calls are unusual, because of what kind of call this one was. Kays had known Eric for years. They hunted together. They hiked demanding trails together, talked at least every other week. He described Eric to the jury as outgoing, magnetic, dependable to his core. If he said he'd be somewhere, he was there. If he said he'd get something done, it was done. That was the Eric that Joshua Kays knew. But the man on the other end of the phone on that Valentine's Day was different. Kays told the jury the call was a lot different from any conversation he had ever had. Eric was somber, serious, sincere in a way that didn't fit the man Kays knew. And because of hearsay rules, the jury never got to hear what Eric actually said during that call. The court carefully worked around it, eliciting only Kays's demeanor and his responses, not the substance of what Eric told him. But here's what we do know. That same morning at 8:55 a.m., a breakfast order was called into a Mirror Lake diner in Camas. A Greek omelet and a bagel sandwich. Paid for in person, picked up at 9:07 a.m., 12 minutes. The name on that matched Corey's. Prosecutors believe she drove that food back home and fed her husband what they allege was his first dose of poison. Eric survived that morning. He would be dead in 3 weeks. Now we know what he ate. All individuals in this story are presumed innocent until proven guilty in a court of law, but what played out in Park City in that courtroom on the ninth day of this trial was something the prosecution had been building towards for 2 weeks. And it arrived not through forensic experts or drug dealers or financial accountants. It arrived through the voices of Corey Richens's closest friends and through Corey's own words, recorded, texted, and read aloud in a room. She can't escape. I'd love to get your thoughts in the comments section as we work through all of this. Substack and YouTube is where you can do that. The links are in the description. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you're at as well. Let's start with Becky Lloyd. Lloyd worked at Eric's masonry company as an estimator. She also knew Corey as a neighbor, a friend, someone she saw regularly. On December 17th of 21, the two of them were wrapping gifts together for a company Secret Santa project. Lloyd had recently gone through a divorce. They were talking about their marriages. Corey told Lloyd she felt trapped, that there was no easy way out, that she feared losing her kids, that Eric's family would turn the community against her. Then she said that in many ways, it would be better if Eric was dead. Lloyd described the tone as serious, heartfelt. She definitely had a very serious tone. We weren't joking. It was a very heartfelt conversation. You could tell she was frustrated and struggling with where she was at. I mean, just think of that for a second. This tells us a lot about Corey Richens, if this account is accurate and true from this witness. Have you ever had a conversation with a friend about your relationship, if it was in a rough spot? Have you ever, like, said to someone it'd be better off if they were dead? Now, I get it if they're abusing the shit out of you, and there are certain circumstances where I understand. But if it ain't that, if it's just more so, I just want this to end, you know? We just kind of went our separate ways, this or that. But to go to death, that's something. And it's interesting, the way that Corey fears and the way that she's projecting that everyone's going to be turned against her. As if she would have had nothing to do with other people's emotions and feelings towards her. They would just simply flip because one person said it. And that she would lose her children just because Eric said so. I mean, that's not the way those things work, unless there's grounds for it. Unless, Corey, you have a track record of proving that this is how things would play out. Basically, you've created your own destruction, and then you're surprised when the wrecking crew and the wrecking ball and the team shows up to take down what you've ordered. You've been planning it all this time, and then it happens. But then she justifies to herself that, well, I only had this part in it. I only did this, or I didn't. I mean, it's the mental gymnastics that someone like Corey Richens allegedly goes through to make sense of life is really, it's stunning. Cognitive distortions is really what it comes down to, because you're never going to make sense of people like this because they don't make sense. They don't make sense to themselves, but they think they do. If you're really trying to, like, go, how is she cognitive distortions? Red is black, black is red, up is down, left is right. But they will tell you with a straight face that, no, that's right. This is my left hand. No, that's your right hand. It's my left hand. What are you talking about? Well, we're going to have to agree to disagree. I mean, this is just, there's no getting around the distortions that they tell themselves, that they believe, and then this is how they operate. This is the track they put down, and then they ride their bike of life all through it. Through the hills, the obstacles, the this, the that. Like, why did you do all that? Why did you create all these difficult obstacles, like when you just want to go fast from point A to point B? What obstacles? What are you talking about? All that. Because smooth and easy and not chaotic is way too foreign of a concept for folks like this, and it's scary. I'm going to take a wild guess that Corey's life has always had a level of chaos to it. Maybe not even of her own making. I'm going to guess around her. And I'm going to guess that this is one of many reasons why Corey is the way she is. The defense played a recording of Lloyd's own prior interview with investigators. In that interview, Lloyd said, and the jury heard this directly, "I swear she said it, but if you put me on the stand, I would not be confident enough to say it," she told investigators. She was 90% sure Corey made the remark. Defense attorney Catherine Nestor pointed out that Lloyd had never mentioned the comment in her first investigator interview and that she only raised it after speaking with Katie Richens, Eric's sister. On its face, that's a credibility hit, the kind the defense attorneys dream about. But then Lloyd did something you don't see every day on a witness stand. She looked at the courtroom and said, without wavering, "I don't want to be here. No one has supplied my testimony to me. I know that it happened. I know she said that. I don't want to say it, but I know she said it." You can argue the legal weight of that all day long. What you can't argue is that it landed. Before the afternoon's heavier evidence arrived, a domestic relations attorney named Marie Bramwell quietly took the stand. She was the 34th witness called by the prosecution. She first met with Corey in person in May of 21 and exchanged approximately 5 emails with her between January of 2022. 1 month before Valentine's Day, 2 months before Eric died. The defense has no questions. Bramwell was released. What she represented, though, wasn't drama. It was a timestamp. Corey was consulting a divorce attorney at the same time prosecutors say she was arranging to get fentanyl. Sometimes the quietest witnesses carry the most. But then came the phone calls. A December 23 jail call between Corey and her brother, Ronnie Darden, was played for the jury after lengthy negotiations over what to redact in the portions that made it through, Corey says, I just went in for a consultation. That was it. So why is that so bad? Am I misunderstanding something? Her brother tells her they're probably trying to hold something against her. She says, he did it first. Then she mentions that she didn't want to fill out some packet, but was told she had to. The jury got no specific context for what she was referring to. They were left to sit with it. And then Chelsea Barney. Chelsea has been Corey's best friend since ninth grade. She testified about being at the Richens' home on March 6th of 2022, the morning after Eric's body was found. Corey was trying to get into Eric's safe to find the will. Eric's sister told Corey the house was no longer hers. A locksmith was called. Amy Richens ran into the garage and physically stopped him. Corey was shaking, crying. According to another witness, she had pure frustration and rage. She collapsed. She was hysterical. Chelsea was there for all of it. What Chelsea may not have fully understood at the time was that her relationship with Corey was actually costing her. She testified that Corey had offered her a home to buy when she was flipping. Chelsea, a restaurant manager who had saved her tips for years, wired Corey $45,000 as a down payment, her life savings. She then paid $2,900 a month in mortgage payments, but the deed was never properly recorded with the county. When Corey was arrested, Chelsea discovered that an unauthorized loan had been taken out on the property without her knowledge. She was evicted in September of 24. The house had been handed over to someone else to cover Corey's debts. The woman standing by her best friend's side in the hours after Eric died had already been quietly cleaned out by her. This is what Corey is capable of. If you don't think she's capable of murder, well, then I'm sorry. There's a lot in life that's escaped you. But Chelsea's testimony cuts deepest not in what happened to her house, but in what she said in those text threads. In May of 22, Corey wrote to Chelsea that investigators had found nothing on either of them, not nothing on me, either of us. Two women in the text exchange, and Corey is already framing it as a shared situation. One where Chelsea apparently needed to be reassured she wasn't in legal jeopardy either. Whether Chelsea understood the weight of what was being said to her is an open question. The jury has it now either way. Then a month later, in June of 22, in an exchange, Chelsea asked Corey, what would you have to put in a sandwich for him to break out in hives? Two best friends in a text thread discussing what could have been an Eric Richens food to make him sick. Corey's response, she didn't make the sandwiches. That's it. No shock. No denial of the premise. Just deflection. Whether Chelsea was trying to help Corey think through her defense or genuinely puzzled about what happened, the jury now has that exchange sitting in front of them. And the answer Corey chose to give. And then there's this. On June 6th of 22, Corey texted Chelsea that she was running to get the death certificate before Eric's sister could. Minutes later, she sent Chelsea a photo of it, the document confirming fentanyl, and writes that she thinks it's finally over and that she's relieved. Not shattered, not devastated. She's relieved. There's no world in which a prosecutor leaves that word alone, and Brad Bloodworth didn't. And then there are the calls to Bryce Cunson, Eric's best friend. Recorded March 19th of 22, just weeks after the funeral. Corey on the call. I don't care about money. It's not a big effing deal to me. Eric has $3 million in life insurance money. I want it all to go to the trust for my kids. Then, within minutes of saying she doesn't care about money, she's listing her properties, 12 of them, describing what she's owed, explaining the $250,000 home equity loan she took without Eric's knowledge, and insisting on keeping the house. Bryce, trying to hold the middle, tells her Eric always said he loved her and the boys. Then he says, and what may be the most unintentionally devastating line anyone has spoken in the entire trial, that if Corey were capable of killing Eric, she would have shot him in the head like 2 years ago. Eric's best friend defending her to her face, not knowing. The jury also heard about a February 21 women's retreat in Sedona, Arizona, where Corey wrote her life story in third person as part of an assignment. She wrote about moving 17 times as a child, her father in prison, her mother's gambling addiction, homes foreclosed, cars repossessed. She wrote about feeling like she was never enough for Eric, about discovering he'd had an emotional affair, about counseling for anxiety and depression, about feeling the need to chase happiness because she never felt she'd found it. She wrote all of this herself more than a year before Eric died. There you go. There's the recipe for Corey Richens. That right there. How do you get somebody with this type of a personality? Bring him up like that, mom and dad. Moving 17 times as a child. Dad's in prison, mom's gambling addiction, homes foreclosed, cars repossessed. Feeling like she was never enough. That's how you make a borderline. That's how you make this type of personality. I mean, there's a level here where you look at Corey and you got to be somewhat sympathetic. I mean, she's a grown-ass adult. She can make her own choices without a doubt. But it's the recipe. That much instability in one's life, in formative years, people who are supposed to be there for you, people who are supposed to be trustworthy to you, and you can't trust them worth a damn. It creates this. Not making an excuse. We're just taking in reality on reality's terms. The prosecution put that in front of the jury not to invite sympathy, but to show the jury who Corey Richens believed herself to be, in her own words, in her own handwriting, before any of this started. And then there was Allie Staking, another childhood friend of Corey's, who testified about a visit on February 20th, 2022, a week before Eric died. Eric told the group laughing that he thought Corey had tried to poison him on Valentine's Day. Everyone laughed. Corey said it was an allergic reaction. Eric joked along. It fit the group dynamic. These were people who teased each other, who told stories at dinner parties, who passed around THC gummies on vacations. Eric laughing about Corey poisoning him was, in that room, a funny story. It was not a funny story to Joshua Kays. He got the real version on Valentine's Day itself, before there was any social distance from it, before it had been processed into dinner party antidote. His version came from a somber, sincere, changed man on the other end of a phone. His version, the one the jury has now, sits alongside the receipt, the deflection that sandwiches, about sandwiches, the either of us, and the word relieved. Prosecutors told Judge Richard Marzik on Thursday that the state is nearly done presenting its case. Lead Detective Jeff O'Driscoll is expected to be the final witness early this next week. Nearly 40 witnesses have testified. What remains to be seen is whether the defense can dismantle what's been built or whether Corey Richens herself decides to take the stand and try to explain in her own voice words she has already spoken that the jury has already heard. The problem with your own words is that they don't need a witness. They just need to be played. Your thoughts in the comment section on YouTube and Substack. We'll continue our conversation there. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you're listening as well. Until next time, my name is Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers Podcast.
Third Love makes bras that actually fit, so they know this. If your bra feels uncomfortable, the problem isn't your body, it's your bra. Third Love designs for comfort first. Soft fabrics, support that doesn't dig, pinch, or slip. Bras that feel good and look good under everything you wear. Shop Third Love and explore over 60 sizes, including AA through H, and half cup sizes you won't find anywhere else. Get $15 off your first purchase at thirdlove.com with code PODCAST15.
Normally in these ads, you'd expect someone like me to ask you to buy something. But I want to ask you to do something different. I'm Dave Farenthold, and I'm a reporter for the New York Times. I'm an investigative reporter, which means that I follow the money, inside of government and outside of government. The point of my job is to find things people are trying to hide. It involves talking to lots of people. It involves looking through lots and lots of documents. And if there weren't folks like me to go beyond the surface to understand who is really shaping what the government does, the public will be left in the dark about what the government's doing with your tax money, what the government's doing to you through regulations and spending. If you're like me and you think this kind of journalism is important, seek out a news source that does firsthand, fact-based reporting. If that's the New York Times, thank you. If that's your local paper, that's great too, because where you get your information matters.